Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello and welcome to this week's RTC Weekly Download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. Well, today we're going to London to do a little bit of crime stuff for you. And we're going back to the beginning of the century, and that's not Y2K, that's the beginning of the 20th century, for the adventures of Sherlock Holmes in an episode called The Abbey Grange. That'll be followed up in about 30 minutes later with The Black Museum, Orson Welles starring in that one. The show is called The Glass Shards. Now here's the great detective himself in Abbey Grange.
I was so firmly bound that I could not move, and a handkerchief round my mouth prevented me from uttering any sound. It was at this instant that my unfortunate husband entered the room. My husband had evidently heard some suspicious sounds and carried his favorite black thorn cudgel in his hand. He rushed at one of the burglars, but another, it was the elderly man, picked the poker out of the grate and struck him a terrible blow. He fell without groan and never moved again.
So the distraught Lady Brackenstall described her husband's death to my friend Sherlock Holmes. My name is Watson, Dr. Watson, and I was privileged to share the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. From my notebooks for 1897... I will tell you what happened in the case of the Abbey Grange. It was on a bitterly cold and frosty morning during the winter of 1897 that I was awakened by a tugging at my shoulder. It was Sherlock Holmes. 10 minutes later, we were both in a cab and rattling through the silent streets on our way to Charing Cross Station. It was not until we consumed some hot tea at the station and taken our places in the Kentish train that we were sufficiently thawed, he to speak and I to listen.
Listen to this, Watson. From Abbey Grange, Marsham, Kent, 3:30 a.m. My dear Mr. Holmes, I should be very glad of your immediate assistance in what promises to be a most remarkable case. It is something quite in your line. Except for releasing the lady, I will see that everything is kept exactly as I have found it. But I beg you not to lose an instant, as it is difficult to leave Sir Eustace there. Yours faithfully, Stanley Hopkins.
Right, and I hope it turns out to be as remarkable as he seems to think.
Inspector Hopkins has called me in 7 times, and on each occasion his summons has been entirely justified. Our present research appears to be a case of murder.
Oh, you think then that Sir Eustace is dead?
I should say so. I think that friend Hopkins will live up to his reputation and that we shall have an interesting morning.
I'm very glad you've come, Mr. Holmes. And you too, Dr. Watson.
Delighted.
But I wish I hadn't troubled you after all.
Oh?
Since the lady has come to herself, she's given us so clear an account of the affair that there's nothing much left for us to do.
Oh.
You remember that Lewisham gang of burglars?
What, the three Randalls?
Father and 2 sons. It's their work, not a doubt of it. They did a job at Sydenham a fortnight ago, and were seen and described. But it's a hanging matter this time.
Sir Eustace is dead, then?
Yes. Head battered in with a poker.
Inspector, who was he exactly?
Sir Eustace Brackenstall, one of the richest men in Kent. Lady Brackenstall is in the morning room, Mr. Holmes. I think you'd best see her and hear her account. Then we'll examine the dining room together.
I have told you all that happened, Inspector Hopkins. Could you not repeat it for me?
If you could manage, milady, I should like Mr. Holmes to hear the facts from your own lips.
Well, if you think it necessary.
Thank you.
Last night, Sir Eustace retired about 10:30. Only my maid, Teresa, was up, and she was in her room at the top of the house. About 11, I walked round to see that all was right before I went upstairs.
Is it your custom to do so?
It is. As I approached the dining room window, a broad-shouldered elderly man stepped through the French window, followed by two others. I stepped back, but the fellow struck me a savage blow with his fist over the eye and felled me to the ground. I must have been unconscious for a few minutes. When I came to myself, I found that they had torn down the bell rope and had secured me tightly to the oaken chair which stands at the head of the dining room table. I was so firmly bound that I could not move, and a handkerchief round my mouth prevented me from uttering any sound. It was at this instant that my unfortunate husband entered the room. My husband had evidently heard some suspicious sounds and carried his favorite black thorn cudgel in his hand. He rushed at one of the burglars, but another, it was the elderly man, picked the poker out of the grate and struck him a terrible blow. He fell without groan and never moved again. I fainted once more. When I opened my eyes, I found that they had collected the silver from the sideboard and that they had drawn a bottle of wine which stood there. Each of them had a glass in his hand. They talked together in whispers, then came over and made sure that I was still securely bound. Finally, they withdrew, closing the window after them. It was quite a quarter of an hour before I got my mouth free, and my screams brought my maid to my assistance. That is really all I can tell you, gentlemen.
Any questions, Mr. Holmes?
No, I will not impose any further tax upon Lady Brackenstall's patience and time. I should be glad to speak to the maid.
Certainly. If you'll be so good as to touch that bell, Dr. Watson.
By all means.
You have told us, Lady Brackenstall, that one of these three men was elderly. What are the others?
They were young men, clean-shaven. They might have been a father with his two sons.
I see.
You rang, your ladyship?
Oh, come in, Teresa. Mr. Sherlock Holmes wishes to speak to you.
Yes, my lady.
I should just like to hear your account of last night, please.
Well, sir, I heard my mistress scream, and down I ran to find her, poor lamb, tied to a chair, and him on the floor lying in his blood. It was enough to drive a woman out of her wits, tied there like that. You've questioned her long enough, you gentlemen. And now she's coming to her room.
I should see that her ladyship gets some rest. She's badly in need of it.
Come along now. Old Teresa will look after you.
She's been with her all her life. Nursed her as a baby and came with her to England from Australia 18 months ago. Teresa Wright is her name. The kind of maid you don't pick up nowadays.
I'm quite sure.
And now, Mr. Holmes, the dining room, I think.
Oh, no doubt about the cause of death, Holmes. It'll take a savage blow to do this.
Here's the poker, you see, Mr. Holmes. Quite bent with the blow.
He must be a powerful man, this Elder Randall.
He's a rough customer, all right.
Well, you should have no difficulty in getting him.
Not the slightest. There was some idea that he'd got away to America before now. But since we know the gang are here, I don't see how they can escape.
What beats me is how they could have done so mad a thing, knowing that the lady would describe them.
Exactly. One would have expected that they would have silenced Lady Brackenstall as well. Though if she were senseless, they would not take her life. But what about this poor fellow, Hopkins?
From what I hear, in spite of all his wealth and title, he very nearly came our way once or twice.
Oh?
Drink, you know. There's a scandal about his drenching her ladyship's dog with petroleum and setting it on fire. And that was only hushed up with difficulty.
Great heavens.
Yes. And he once threw a decanter at that maid, Teresa Wright. There was trouble about that. Between ourselves, it'll be a brighter house without him. What are you looking at now, Mr. Holmes?
This bell rope, which they used to tie Lady Brackenstall to the chair.
What about it?
When they pulled it down from the wall, the bell in the kitchen must have rung loudly.
No one could hear it. The servants had all retired.
But how did the burglar know that?
Ah, exactly, Mr. Holmes. I've asked myself that question. There can be no doubt that this fellow must have known the house and its habits. Therefore, he must have been in close league with one of the servants.
Well, when you have Randall, you'll probably find no difficulty in securing his accomplices, Hopkins.
That's true. Oh, I told you I was sorry to have brought you down here.
What did they take, by the way?
Well, not much, only half a dozen articles of plate off the sideboard. Lady Brackenstall thinks that they were so disturbed by the death of Sir Eustace that they didn't ransack the house as they'd intended.
And yet they drank some wine.
To steady their nerves, I suppose.
These three glasses on the sideboard have not been touched, Hopkins.
No, Mr. Holmes, and the bottle stands there as they left it.
Let us look at it. Hello? Hello, what's this? Lady Brackenstall actually saw the three men drinking, did she not?
Yes, she was clear about that.
Well, then there's an end of it. What more is to be said? And yet you must admit that the three glasses are very remarkable, Hopkins.
Remarkable? I don't see, Mr. Holmes.
No? Well, let it pass. Perhaps when a man has special knowledge and special powers like my own, it rather encourages him to seek a complex explanation when a simpler one is at hand. Well, good morning, Hopkins. I trust that I shall soon have to congratulate you upon a successful conclusion. Come, Watson, I fancy that we may employ ourselves more profitably at home.
Holmes, what on earth are you up to now? We get halfway to London, and you suddenly insist on dragging me off the train at this suburban halt and not a refreshment room in sight.
Excuse me, my dear fellow. I'm sorry to make you the victim of what may seem a mere whim. But on my life, I simply can't leave that case in this condition. Every instinct I possess cries out against it. It's wrong. It's all wrong. I swear that it's wrong.
The lady's story was complete and the maid's corroboration was exact. What have you to put against that?
Three wine glasses, that's all.
Three wine?
Now, sit down on this bench, Watson, until a train for Chislehurst arrives.
Thank you.
And allow me to lay the evidence before you, imploring you to dismiss from your mind the idea that anything which the maid or her mistress may have said must necessarily be true.
Very well, as you wish.
These burglars made a considerable haul at Sydenham a fortnight ago.
Yes.
Burglars who have done a good stroke of business are, as a rule, only too glad to enjoy the proceeds in peace and quiet before embarking on another perilous undertaking.
Yes, I suppose that's true.
Again, it's unusual for burglars to operate at so early an hour. It is unusual for them to commit murder when their numbers are sufficient to overpower one man. It is unusual for them to be content with a limited plunder when there is much more within their reach. And finally, I should say that it was very unusual for such men to leave a bottle half empty. How do all these unusuals strike you, Watson?
Well, Holmes, their cumulative effect is certainly considerable, and yet each of them is quite possible in itself.
But now comes the incident of the wine glasses.
What about the wine glasses?
Can you see them in your mind's eye?
I see them clearly.
We're told that three men drank from them. Does that strike you as likely?
Oh, why not? There was wine in each glass.
Exactly, but there was sediment only in one glass. Now, what does that suggest to your mind?
Well, I should say the last glass to be filled would be most likely to contain sediment.
Not at all. That particular bottle was full of it. And it is inconceivable that the first two glasses were clear and the third heavily charged with it. No, I'm inclined to believe that only two glasses were used and the sediment which remained in them both was poured into a third glass to make it appear that three persons had drunk.
Well...
Yes, I'm convinced that this is so. But if I've hit upon the true explanation of this one small phenomenon, then in an instant the case rises from the commonplace to the exceedingly remarkable.
You mean that Lady Brackenstall and her maid have deliberately lied to us?
If so, it can only mean they have some very strong reason for covering the real criminal. In which case, we must arrive at our solution for ourselves without any help from them. And here, Watson, is the Chislehurst train.
Good.
I imagine they'll be surprised to see us return so soon to the Abbey Grange.
Satisfied now, Holmes. You've gone over this blessed dining room with a fine-tooth comb, almost.
It's all right, Watson. We've got our case.
What?
One of the most remarkable in our collection. But, dear me, how slow-witted I've been. How near I came to committing the blunder of my lifetime.
You've got your men?
Man, Watson. Man. Only one. But a very formidable person. Strong as a lion. Witness the blow which bent that poker. 6'3" in height, active as a squirrel, dexterous with his fingers.
Where was the clue that has made your mind up?
That bell rope.
That?
You saw me climb up to examine it. It is cut clean off, 3 inches from the top.
Yes, but...
Kindly ring for the maid while we reconstruct what happened.
All right.
Now, the man needed the rope. He wouldn't tear it down for fear of giving the alarm by ringing the bell, so he sprang up onto the mantelpiece, I could see the impression in the dust, and got his knife to bear upon the cord. I could not reach the place by at least 3 inches, from which I infer that he is at least 3 inches a bigger man than I.
Ah, I see.
We've not yet met our Waterloo, Watson, but this is our Marengo, for it begins in defeat and ends in victory. Ah, Teresa, kindly come in and close the door.
Yes, sir.
Teresa, I'm shocked and deeply distressed to learn that on one unhappy occasion, the late Sir Eustace Brackenstall actually threw a decanter at you.
Well, sir, since you raised the matter, I won't deny that it's true. It's not for me to speak ill of the dead, mind you.
Oh, quite, quite.
But I heard him call my mistress a name, and I told him he would not dare to speak so if her brother had been there. Then it was he threw it at me. He was always ill-treating her, sir.
When did she meet him, by the way?
He arrived in June, and she met him in July. They were married in January of last year. What was it you wanted, sir?
Oh, I wondered if Lady Brackenstall might feel able to spare me a few moments of her time, if you think she's up to it, of course.
I don't doubt she'll see you, sir.
Ah.
She's down in the morning room, if you'll follow me. But you won't ask too much of her, sir. She's gone through all that flesh and blood will stand.
I do hope you've not come to cross-examine me again, Mr. Holmes.
No, I will not cause you any unnecessary trouble, Lady Brackenstall. Believe me, my whole desire is to make things easy for you. But I'm convinced that you are a much tried woman. Now, if you'll treat me as a friend and trust me, you may find that I will justify your trust.
What do you want me to do?
To tell me the truth.
Mr. Holmes.
No, 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 Lady Brackenstall, it's no use. You may have heard of any little reputation which I possess. I will stake it all on the fact that your story is an absolute fabrication.
You are an impudent fellow to talk to my mistress like that. Do you mean to say she has told you a lie?
Have you nothing to tell me, Lady Brackenstall?
I have told you everything.
Think once more. Would it not be better to be frank?
I have told you all I know.
I'm sorry. Come along, Watson.
Oh, you've rubbed them both up the wrong way, Holmes. Where's it got us?
It may be a hit or it may be a miss. I'll just scribble a note for the lodge keeper to give Stanley Hopkins when he returns. And then I think our next scene of operations must be the shipping office of the Adelaide Southampton line. It's at the end of Pall Mall, if I remember right.
Pray be seated, gentlemen.
Thank you, Colonel.
Now, Mr. Holmes, what can I do for you?
I'm making one or two inquiries concerning two ladies who arrived in this country from Adelaide in June of 95.
June 95?
Yes.
Well, that should be easy. Here's the ledger for that month.
Oh, a Miss Fraser and her maid, Miss Wright.
Fraser. Ah, yes, here it is. Miss Mary Fraser from Adelaide, travelling with her maid, Miss Teresa Wright. The Rock of Gibraltar. That what you wanted?
Capital. May I ask where the Rock of Gibraltar is now?
Now? Oh, she's halfway to Australia, somewhere south of Suez.
I see. I imagine her officers are still much the same as they were 18 months ago.
I don't think... Oh, just a moment, though. Captain Croker.
The master of the Rock of Gibraltar?
Oh, no, no. He was first officer on the voyage you refer to.
Oh.
He's recently been promoted to captain and left the ship. Matter of fact, he takes charge of our newest vessel, the Bass Rock, sailing from Southampton in 2 days' time.
Captain Croker.
Splendid seaman. Magnificent record. Not an officer in the fleet to touch Jack Croker.
Well, I'm much obliged to you for your assistance. And now I think we've trespassed enough upon your valuable time.
I'm getting rather lost, Holmes.
Oh?
You haven't explained what, if anything, our visit to that shipping office achieved. You sent off a telegram, which you didn't find it necessary to let me see. And then you drive to Scotland Yard, sit outside in the cab for 10 minutes, lost in thought, and then drive back here to 221B without going into the yard at all. What's it all about?
I couldn't do it, Watson.
Couldn't do what?
Once that warrant was made out, nothing on earth would save him. And I had rather play tricks with the law of England than with my own conscience. Let us know a little more before we act.
Oh, Holmes, really, I don't... Come in.
Ah, Hopkins. Do come in.
Your landlady told me to come up, Mr. Holmes.
Quite right, I was expecting to see you. Take a seat.
Thank you. Mr. Holmes, I believe you're a wizard.
Oh, how so?
How on earth could you know that the stone and silver was at the bottom of the pond in the Abbey Grange grounds?
I didn't know it.
But you told me to try the pond, in the notes you left with the lodgekeeper.
Well, I just thought it was possible. We were told the men left by the French window. Almost immediately outside it, there was the pond. Could there be a better hiding place?
Ah, a hiding place. Yes, as I see it all now. Excellent, Mr. Holmes. But I must tell you, I've had a bad setback.
A setback, Inspector?
Yes, Dr. Watson. The Randall gang were arrested in New York this morning.
New York?
Dear me, Hopkins. That is certainly rather against your theory that they committed a murder in Kent last night.
It's fatal, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, let us know how you get on.
Yes, I will.
Goodbye, Inspector. Well, Holmes?
I expect developments, Watson.
When?
Within a few minutes. I dare say you thought I acted rather badly to Stanley Hopkins just now.
No, I trust your judgment.
A very sensible reply. Ah, I hear a footfall upon our stair. The time has come. You will now be present at the last scene of a remarkable little drama. Come in.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Come in, Captain Croker. Ah. Take a seat. This is my friend Dr. Watson.
How do you do, Captain?
How do you do?
You got my telegram.
I got your telegram, and here I am. What do you wish me to do?
To give me a true account of all that happened at the Abbey Grange last night. A true account, mind you, with nothing added and nothing taken off. I know so much already that if you go one inch off the straight, I'll blow this police whistle from my window and the affair goes out of my hands forever.
I'll tell you my story, gentlemen, and then I'll ask you as man to man what less I could have done.
Pray proceed.
I expect that you know that I first met Mary Fraser when she was a passenger and I was first officer of the Rock of Gibraltar. From that moment, she was the only woman for me.
Indeed.
But she was never engaged to me. It was all love on my side and all good companionship and friendship on hers.
I understand perfectly. Go on.
Well, I never thought to see her again. At last voyage, I was promoted. And I've been staying since with my people at Sydenham waiting for my new boat. One day, out in the country, I met Teresa Wright, her maid. She told me about him. About everything. And I tell you, gentlemen, it nearly drove me mad. Well, from Teresa, I learned the ways of the house. Mary used to sit up, reading, downstairs. I crept round there last night and scratched at the window till she heard me.
Who is it? Who's there?
Mary. It's me.
Jack. Jack Croker.
Mary, let me in. I must speak to you.
Oh, I can't.
You must.
Oh, quickly, then. Can you climb through?
Just watch me. Now, Mary, I want you to tell me. And the truth, mind. Is it true what I've been hearing from Teresa? Does he hit you? Knock you about?
He... Oh, what's the use of pretending? Yes, Jack. Whatever you've heard, I'm sure it's no more than the truth.
Oh,
God.
No. Who are you putting your filthy hands on my wife? I might have known something like this was going on behind me.
Eustace, this is only
you
a...
shut up, you low stupid! Oh. I'll serve you my neck. Touch her once again and I'll see about that. Now then, you brute!
What's happening?
Who?
He was striking her with his stick, Teresa. He went for me. I had this poker. I think he must be...
Yes,
He's dead. And good riddance at last.
Well, what are we going to do?
It's got to seem as if burglars did this.
What?
You must do exactly as I say. We're going to hide some of the silver and leave the French window open as if they'd escaped that way. And we'll tie my mistress to that chair. Look, that bell rope. Get it down, we'll use that. While you're doing it, I'm going to tell her the tale she must tell when all this comes out. Now, hurry, we've no time to waste. There, my poor dove. Old Teresa's going to make everything all right.
I opened a bottle of wine, and Mary and I took a glass apiece to calm us. Teresa suggested pouring some off into a third glass. It looked as if some gang of three had done it. Well, that's the whole truth of it, gentlemen, if it costs me my neck.
Captain Croker, I believe every word you've said, for you've hardly told me a thing I didn't know. No one but an acrobat or a sailor could have got up to that bell rope, and no one but a sailor could have tied the knots with which it was fastened to the chair. Only once had this lady been brought into contact with sailors, and that was on her voyage. And it was someone of her own class of life, since she was trying hard to shield him, and so showing that she loved him. Now look here, Captain. We'll do this in due form of law. You are the prisoner. Watson.
Yes?
You are a British jury. I am the judge. Now, gentlemen of the jury, you have heard the evidence. Do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty, my lord.
You are acquitted, Captain Croker. So long as the law does not find some other victim, you are safe from me. Come back to this lady in a year, and may her future and yours justify us in the judgment which we have pronounced this night.
The Abbey Grange was one of the Sherlock Holmes stories from the inspired pen of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. My real name, is Norman Shelley. My friend Carlton Hobbs played Sherlock Holmes, and I was Dr. Watson. Michael Hardwick wrote the script for this BBC production from London. I look forward to the pleasure of your company again soon for more of the adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Now we move ahead a couple of decades for an episode of The Black Museum. This is called The Glass Shards.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames which houses Scotland Yard is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a paperweight, a woolen muffler, an old-fashioned hatpin, a drinking glass, all are touched by murder. Here's a bit of frosted glass. It's a familiar object. You've seen such glass before in the upper panels of the doors of older houses, and perhaps the one in which you live. Let's in more light, the owner used to say. One man climbing to his old-fashioned apartment said to his son,
"Hello, what's this? Glass on the landing?"
"From the door, Dad. It looks like a frosted panel fell out."
"Yes, and pretty jaggedly. Be careful, son. Those shards are sharp."
Well, today the glass shards can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
And here we are, the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Yes, here lies death. Here's a pacifier, nippled end, ivory ring. This in the Black Museum, yes. Because it seems there was a will. And where there's a will, there's a way. Even to infanticide. Here's a pair of andirons. Brass, graceful in pattern, clean in execution. Execution. Observe the shining brass of this one, the ugly blotch on the other. A woman is pushed violently. Her head strikes with malice aforethought. This was murder. Nice. Here we are, the glass shards. They're sharp, pointed. Dangerous to life and limb, even in themselves. Here they are, glistening, gleaming in their whitely frosted danger. Once they were part of a whole. The glass panel, as I told you, of an apartment door. But we'll come to that. Let's begin this tale with the ringing of a doorbell.
Maybe no one is home. Well, we'll try again.
Sorry to have kept you waiting.
Sorry to have disturbed you, ma'am. I've been sent looking for a chauffeur. Chap name of Simmons.
There's no one here by that name. And I can tell you, sir, there's no one by that name been in this neighbourhood. Well, not in my memory, and I've lived here about 20 years.
Oh, well, thank you, ma'am. Garage really works, the Beacon, it's called. Well, they'll have to find another errand boy if they can't give me better steers than this. Well, good day, ma'am.
Good day. That's a bit strange. There's no Beacon Garage in this neighbourhood.
Of course, this was not a neighbourhood for garages and items of that sort. This was strictly residential. Mostly semi-detached houses with a bit of garden and an occasional block of apartments, or flats, as they're still called in London. Into one of those apartment houses came Charles Fly and his son, Charles Jr., home after their respective days' work at business and college.
When will they put lights in these stairs, Dad?
Not if someone breaks a leg in the dark. I just hope it isn't your mother.
So do I. Well, watch the landing. Dad turns just ahead.
I know. Hello, what's this? Glass on the landing?
From the door, Dad. Looks like the frosted panel fell out.
Yes, and pretty jaggedly. Be careful, son. Those shards are sharp.
I said, do you suppose Mother let the door slam so hard the glass broke?
Well, I'll ask her when we get inside. Your key handy?
Right here, Dad.
Thanks. Funny, I've never known your mother to use the chain on the door in her life.
Oh, with the glass broken like that?
What good's the chain? I can reach in and flip off the chain from here through the broken glass.
Dad, there's someone in there.
Oh, your mother, probably. No, it's not. It's a man. A little fellow. Junior, yes? Get on down to Riverdale Road. There's a police box there. Call him, quickly.
What about you, Dad?
Go on now, I'll stay here and watch him. Hurry!
Yes, all right, if you say so.
Chain's off now. Why not? He's only a little fellow. Here now, what are you putting in my suitcase?
You shouldn't have come in, Governor. It won't do you a bit of good. I'm leaving with your suitcase and what I've packed in it.
Drop it back. I can handle you. No!
So foolhardy. Mr. Fly should have stayed outside. He might have stayed alive. As it was when the police did arrive with Charles Fry Jr., Senior was very dead. The call to Scotland Yard was automatic after that. Inspector Howard proceeded with the preliminary questioning as his technical experts combed the apartment.
I know you had quite a shock, my boy, but we need your help, and right now.
I'll try my best, Inspector.
We've checked the apartment. The intruder, whoever he was, had packed a suitcase and was about ready to leave.
It's Dad's own. It was his suitcase.
All right. Now, is there anything else you know of that's missing?
Mother said something before she collapsed about her bracelet. I looked. It's missing.
Can you describe it in detail? On items like that, we publish it in the Yard's Daily Gazette. It's circularized to every station, jeweler, and pawn shop in England.
Well, it was gold, about an inch wide, engraved with a kind of floral design, and there were 25 diamonds, small ones, in the pattern. Dad gave it to Mother on her 25th anniversary.
I see. Very good. Now, you've been an excellent help, and you're certain he was a short man.
Well, I saw him through the broken pane. He was just about 5 feet tall. Quite a little fellow. I guess that's why Dad went in after him. Dad didn't... No, he had a gun.
Housebreakers try to stay away from guns in England. The penalties are too severe. Yes, Sergeant?
No M.O., sir. Just the broken pane of glass.
Thank you. Anything beyond that first shell?
Not a thing. One shot was fired, that's all.
No M.O., sir.
Means of operation. Anything that's recognizable. Most of these people have a kind of trademark. Completely subconscious, but it helps us to find them.
Too bad there's nothing, then.
We'll do our best. All right, Sergeant. I want the neighborhood canvassed. Did anyone notice a small man sounding the drum? Did anyone see a small man leaving the premises? And check every carnival, fair, and circus for a small fellow who's a sharpshooter. One cartridge, one shot, and bullseye. Got that, Sergeant?
Aye, sir.
We can make a start anyway, and here's hoping...
Police routine. Sounding the drum. It's a new term. What does it mean? Listen to the sergeant as he canvasses the neighborhood.
Tell me, ma'am. In the past day or so, has anyone rung your bell and asked for someone who doesn't live here and left in a hurry?
Do you follow the term now? It's what Americans would call casing the joint. Find out if anyone's home by ringing the bell. If there is, make an excuse and get away fast. If there isn't, find a way to break in and steal whatever may be lying about within easy reach. It's simple, effective, very professional. But the police are professionals, too.
Excuse me, sir. I'm from the CID. Sergeant Gordon, my credentials.
Oh, what's up?
I'm making inquiries to see if anyone's called at your house in the past few days.
What? Oh, no. We've all been away the past 2 weeks. We only got back today.
Oh, well, thank you then. Sorry to trouble you.
Yes?
Forgive me for troubling you, ma'am. I'm Sergeant Gordon, CID. My credentials.
What's happened? We aren't in any trouble, are we?
Now, calm yourself, ma'am. No trouble for you, at any rate. It's just that I wanted to ask you a question or two.
Oh, yes.
Could you tell me if anyone has called at your house during the past few days and asked for someone who doesn't live here, and that if they were in?
What a silly question.
No, ma'am. It's a very serious question. So, will you put your mind to it?
Well, no. I'm absolutely sure. Nobody.
Yes? Sergeant Gordon, CID. My credentials.
Yes?
Has anyone rung your bell in the past few days and asked for someone who doesn't live here?
No.
Thank you.
Yes?
Sorry to disturb you, ma'am. I'm Sergeant Gordon, CID. My credentials.
Oh, please. Yes?
Did you... That is, has anyone rung your bell in the past few days and asked for someone who doesn't live here?
Oh, that'd be a foolish thing. Why, yes. There was. Just yesterday afternoon. He asked for a chauffeur or something. Said the fellow worked at the Beacon Garage.
And you remembered this?
Oh, I certainly did.
Why, ma'am?
Well, because there's no such place hereabouts as the Beacon Garage. And I ought to know. I've lived here 20 years.
I see. Rather a foolish error.
Now that you mention it, I'm not sure that it was an error. He seemed rather a nasty little man.
Oh, is that so? Why?
Too dapper, too quick. Much too little for a man. He was shorter than I am, and I'm only 5'2".
Could you describe him in more detail, perhaps?
Well, he had dark hair, grew very low on his head, and his eyes were sort of shifty. Blue, but shifty.
Uh-huh.
A kind of thing you see in the cinema. You know, in those pictures about bookmaking and that.
Anything else, ma'am?
Well, not that I remember. Not offhand, at any rate.
Now, two people still living have seen this little man, the dead man's son, and the woman at whose door he sounded the drum. A description is in hand, two descriptions, which tally in every point. And then Sergeant Gordon came into Inspector Howard's office with another fact, a very solid fact.
What's this, Sergeant?
The weapon, sir. Found it behind the hedge of number 21, three houses up from the flats where Flyer was killed.
How'd you get onto it?
We found a young fellow who'd been walking his girl past the flats on her way from the bus. This little man ran out of the flats, almost knocked the girl over, but he kept going. Our young fellow turned around to protest, saw him throw something over the hedge. We looked. There it is.
Nasty little gun. Well, shell jammed in the chamber.
No wonder he fired only one shot.
But he pulled the trigger twice. Well, we can drop our search in the circuses, Sergeant. I doubt if this fellow is the sharpshooter we thought he was. I think now we'll concentrate on classification by size. Shall we get to it, Sergeant? We seem to have our work cut out for us again.
Surely the picture takes shape. Dim at first, as if seen through frosted glass. Like the glass shards to be seen today in the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Again, it's compounded of hard work, good police training, and a little luck. They start with nothing, this time with a wrong theory that their man is a sharpshooter. They have to abandon this, and they start fresh with the dullest and therefore the hardest kind of police routine, checking the files.
He's a little man. Everyone's agreed on that. Ask criminal records to send us the dossiers on every man we have on file under 5'2" in height.
Carefully, the inspector in charge and his sergeant comb through these dossiers, and finally, by reason of cross-checking, this one in jail at the moment of the crime, that one in some other part of the country, others with perfect alibis, the list of little fellows is reduced to 4.
You take these two, Sergeant. I'll work over the others. Anything that rings a bell, the smallest detail.
Yes, sir.
For over an hour, the two men are silent, reading, thinking, trying to relate something in the files to the facts that they already have. And then they exchange dossiers and start again. By this time, the lamps are lighted. The Thames flows like black glass outside the window of the inspector's office. All at once.
I may have something, sir.
Which file?
Larry Mason. His nearest relatives, an uncle and an aunt, are recorded here as living in Beacon Road.
Does that mean anything to you, Sergeant? It doesn't to me.
You'll see it in my report in passing, Inspector.
Uh-huh.
When I talked with the woman who'd seen the fellow sounding the drum, he told her the chauffeur he was looking for worked at the Beacon Garage.
Oh.
And she made quite a fuss over the fact that there is no such garage in the neighborhood. She was quite emphatic about it.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Let me see the description. I see. 5 feet, 1.5 inch. The smallest of the lot. Beacon Garage, eh? And relatives on Beacon Road.
Not important, perhaps. And yet, all important, as the inspector thought it through.
We'll say a man needs a false name at a sudden moment. He says the first thing that comes into his mind. It seems rather natural that the place his nearest relatives live should be lurking somewhere just below his consciousness. Well, it's mighty slim, but it's worth a try.
And having decided it was worth a try, Inspector Howard and Sergeant Gordon set out to trace their prime, if tiny, suspect.
Mason? Yes, he lived here.
Oh, lived? You mean he's left?
He didn't leave.
What then, ma'am? Did he die?
He could have, for all I care. I threw him out. Didn't pay his rent for 3 weeks. I can't afford deadheads, I can't.
Have you any idea where he's gone?
No. What's more, I don't care.
Next point of inquiry was the Beacon Road address and Larry Mason's uncle.
About your nephew, Mr. Mason.
What about him?
Have you any idea of his whereabouts?
Who wants to know?
My name is Howard, Inspector, Scotland Yard.
In trouble, is he again?
We're not certain yet. He may be. We'd like to talk to him.
Well, if you find him, I'd like to talk to him too. Long enough to tell him not to come round for me for help.
Sergeant Gordon visited the pubs and hangouts where Larry Mason had been known to spend his time. In one of them, he found a friend of Mason's.
Larry? I ain't seen him in a long time. Not since he was sent away for breaking and injuring. He hasn't been round at all. And I can't say I'm sorry.
No? Why not, friend?
He worked for me when I had my license and was making a book legitimate. He was my clerk, see? Then one day he walks off, just like that, with 10 quid. I don't expect to see him again. He knows that little job cost me my license. And he knows what'll happen to him if he shows his face in here again.
Not much to go on, or to find a man, except the brush strokes that fill the picture of the little fellow's character. Unreliable, a thief, where his friends are concerned. Now, think back a minute. Remember the Daily Gazette the Yard publishes with descriptions of stolen goods, missing persons, and so on.
Teletype from the Lancashire Police, Inspector.
Huh?
They've got the bracelet in the fly case. A pawnbroker turned it up.
Good.
It was offered to him by a tall, heavy-set fellow with a peculiar circular scar on his right cheek.
That sounds like Dick Lowry. Let's have Mr. Lowry in here, shall we?
Mr. Lowry was quite glad to oblige. He wasn't in hiding or anything like that, not Dick Lowry.
Where'd you get it, Lowry? The inspector wants to know.
Where'd I get what?
The bracelet you pawned in Bolton.
I found it.
You found it, did you?
That's what I said. Anything wrong in that?
If you found it, no. We think you bought it.
Well, now, what would I buy a bracelet with sparklers in it for? My girls don't go for that sort of thing.
You sold it, didn't you?
Oh, of course. Why not? A fellow can do with a spot of cash.
Larry!
Yes, Inspector?
You may want to know. That bracelet is involved in a killing.
A killing, is it? Why, that dirty little...
Oh? Go on, Lowry.
Start talking, Lowry. Accessory after the fact in a murder can be very nasty, you know.
All right. I bought it. I paid a good price, too.
From whom? Lowry, from whom?
Larry Mason.
Well, at last. Where'd you see him, Lowry?
Oh, the usual place. Dog track. With him, it's horses or dogs when the nags aren't running.
Finally, the patience was bringing results, as it almost always does. Canvass a whole neighborhood, comb through hundreds of files, slowly, narrow the possibilities, and finally, a direct relation is established between the crime and some person who may have committed it. After that, find the person. In this case, it was the dog tracks. South End.
He's not here, Sergeant.
The White City Raceway.
Not a sign, Inspector.
Wembley.
They know him here, but he hasn't been around in weeks.
And back to South End.
No luck again, sir.
No luck is right. Tell me, Sergeant, do you suppose a pint of ale will help our patients any?
Aye. This one seems rather decent, Inspector.
Yes, let's get on with it.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to come against you.
That's all right. No harm done.
Hold it, young fella. I think I know you.
Do you? Where from?
You're Larry Mason.
Not me. My name's Leonard Martinson.
Sorry, you'll have to prove your identity. We're from Scotland Yard.
A twist of luck, a turn of chance. Two weary policemen in search of a relaxing moment run across the killer they've been hunting for weeks. At the yard, Larry Mason was not having a particularly relaxing time of it.
Do you insist on denying you're Larry Mason?
I do.
Look, Mason, you've been away for a while. Now you know about these things. Your fingerprints are the prints on Mason's record. Dick Lowry swears he bought the bracelet from you. Your landlady and your former bookmaking associate have identified you. Now let's have no more nonsense.
I ain't giving you a thing. Just because I'm small don't mean you can push me around.
Ah, you'd better tell us the whole story, Mason, and stop this nonsensical denial. You'll go to trial anyway, you know. And the more you lie now, the harder it'll be on you later. Now speak up, Mason.
You know, they get stubborn streaks sometimes. They read somewhere, somehow, that the best defense is to admit nothing, not even their own identity. So they firmly shut their mouths and refuse to talk about anything except the weather. The sergeant knew they had a case, a good case. Inspector Howard came in to help.
I look at it this way, Mason. You can't do yourself any harm. We've got the evidence, we've got the gun. We're in the process of tracing it to you right now. The woman you spoke to will identify you in court. You had the bracelet. You've no alibi worth mentioning. You'll hang on what we've got, Mason, unless you've something which makes it manslaughter in place of murder.
All right. It was an accident. I never used a gun before. Never even had one.
The first time is always one too many when it comes to guns. Now keep talking. How was it an accident?
I broke the glass, see? After nobody answered the bell. I stuck my hand in. It was a cinch to open the door. I worked fast, but this fella come home early or something. I tried to make the back door. No luck, it was locked with a key.
So you had to come to the front.
He was a lot bigger than me. I pulled the gun because I wanted to scare him, that's all. He jumped me, hit me with something. I blacked out. That's it, I blacked out. Didn't even hear the gun go off.
And when you came to, Mason?
He was dead on the floor. I got out of there as fast as I could get. It was an accident. I swear it was an accident.
What's your opinion, Sergeant?
It's a good story, but it won't wash.
Why not? That's what happened. Why not?
It's very simple, Mason. You blacked out as you pulled the trigger. Therefore, you fired only once.
Yes, sir. Only once.
Sorry, Mason. You pulled that trigger twice. There was a shell jammed in the firing chamber. You pulled the trigger at least twice. That's no accident, Mason. That's murder.
Yes, the case was complete. Each part in its correct place. And those glass shards I told you about, those two are in their correct place. In the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
Oh,
In person is Orson Welles.
The jury quite agreed with Inspector Howard. That was no accident. And so in due course, little Larry Mason, the bookie's clerk who made the fatal error of carrying a pistol, went the way of most murderers at 8 o'clock one summer morning. Larry Mason's luck had run out, or had it? It was reported, you see, that as he walked to the scaffold with its 13 steps and waiting rope, Mason murmured to his guards. They had to do this now on June 6th. Derby Day. And me with a few shillings riding on Armstrong in the big race. Curiously, although Mason wasn't available to collect on his bet, Armstrong was the winning horse at 53-1. And now until we meet next time, until we meet in the same place and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain as always, obediently yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, is presented by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Radio Attractions. The program is written by Ara Marion, with original music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.